Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvelize. I'm your host, David Price. Thank you for joining me today. You're going to hear from, from Steve. Steve's going to have a, first, Steve is joined by Kevin and Phil and Andrew. They're going to talk about Secret Wars number 2, some of the tie-ins that take place on this great big old battle world. And then Steve's going to stick around for a few minutes and talk about a couple things. So that is what you have to look forward to. Speaking of Secret Wars, speaking of Battleworld, I've read almost all of them. If not, I'm in the middle of reading Ultimate End, number one. It has the Battleworld logo on the top. It also, I believe it has a little Secret Wars logo on the cover, but I read Spider-Verse number one. That one's really interesting to me because you have, nobody's really seen Spider-Man in a while, weeks, months. So I'm curious to know what the hell that's all about and whether or not other Spider-Man-esque tie-ins to Secret Wars will reference this this disappearance. There was also Deadpool's Secret Wars, which was a lot of fun, and I did like how it lined up a lot of what went on in that first issue of Secret Wars way back in 1984, and obviously some of the dialogue was changed because it just makes sense in Deadpool's head for people to say things that they said, react to him the way they reacted. I had absolutely no problem with any of that. I'm not worried about it being retconned or actually canon, I'll say. But it was a lot of fun. Cullen Bunn is one of my favorite Deadpool writers, and that's not a long list, I realize that, but what I have heard of Deadpool, Cullen is definitely up there for me. There was the Secret Wars Battle World, which put together two of my favorite characters in the beginning of the first story. That was cool. There was this Planet Hulk, which is, oh my god, it's gorgeous, with beautiful art by Mark Laming in the beginning, in the first story. And as I told the guys on Messenger, Mark was born to draw this book. You got a giant T-Rex usually only come in one size. But you got a T-Rex, you have hulking behemoths, you have a Captain America looking rather large and in charge. So Mark is just, it's beautiful work. It's almost like he was coming home. Master of Kung Fu was probably one that was kind of low key, but I really, really enjoyed it. I think I've an A-Force, which I didn't know what to expect. I'm liking them all. I haven't read a bad one in the bunch. We talked about Avengers and everything leading up to Secret Wars on the show. We've talked about the first issue or two of Secret Wars on 11 O'Clock Comics. We haven't talked about any of the tie-ins yet, any of the issues dealing with life on Battleworld. The only thing connecting everything is that Doom is God, and we all bow to him on this battle world, and the shield has been broken in an issue or two, and the Deadlands are there. Nothing feels like it's disconnected. Every issue, every one of these tie-ins has a unique feel, but there is there's definitely something hanging over them all that connects each and every one of them, and you're not hit over the head with it. That's one thing that's different about this Secret Wars compared to the one from many decades ago. You're not hit over the head with constant reminders of knowing who everybody is, what they can do, what it's just not as heavy-handed in that regard. The first page or so lets you know what happened between Earth 616 and Earth 1610, and how they were the only two Earths that were surviving the incursion, and this is what happened with all the multiverses landing on one big place and one big planet, one big battle world. It is, you know, I don't know if you're not sure what the hell's going on, it really kind of is a blank slate for all involved, because I mean there are things that we're still finding out as you read the issues. So it's kind of we're all on a level playing ground. I mean, you may know who a character is and therefore what his power set may be, or what kind of baggage he may be bringing with him, but you're not really sure, especially in the Spider-Verse one. You know, the whole Billy Braddock and whether or not he has spider sense. You know, I mean, these are little things that I didn't know, but because I don't remember really picking that up during the Spider-Verse event from a few months ago. But no, I like I said, every issue that I've read so far, I've really, really enjoyed. I am catching up on Daredevil, and as we get to the conclusion of the Mark Waid and Chris Samnee run, that ends, I think, with issue 18. I just read 15. I have 15.1 in the queue ready to go, and that has been really, well, it's been a feast for the eyes, but this final arc is, I'm worried. I'm worried about Matt a little bit, I'm going to say, and just the things that he's going through to solve this final case, and the bad guy for this arc. Not really the one I expected, although it makes sense based on earlier issues of this volume, but it's little reminiscent somewhat of Born Again, where you kind of have to bring the hero down before he can, I guess, rise up again. So that I'm enjoying, because Born Again is one of my favorite stories of all time. So why wouldn't I love something that is somewhat reminiscent of that fantastic story? There are a couple things that I am trying to catch up on, so I'm going to just get back to that. I dug out a bunch of, took a stack of books with me outside today. It was a gorgeous day, and reading on the deck, and I had a bunch of late 80s, a few issues between 84... No, because I have 75 in here. Early 70s to issue 102. I have a handful of issues of Power Man and Iron Fist. So you have like Gary Gamel and Trevor Von Eden, Dennis Cowan on art. It's all, you have Mike Mignola on inks, which is weirded me out a little bit. So I'm really looking forward to reading some more of those. There's also some Star Wars that I have, I said, queued up right next to, right next to the Daredevil. So I'm going to let the guys do their thing. I'm done talking. I'm really enjoying Secret Wars. I hope you are too. If you have any questions, hit us up on Facebook, on Twitter. Marvel Noise is it all one word? Is the Twitter handle for the podcast? And Steve is on Facebook and on Twitter and is manning the Marvel Noise Twitter. So ask a question there and it will be answered. So The guys are going to do their thing. I'm out of here. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Secret Wars. What's Dr. Jules' mission? Secret Shield? Zap Captain America with my Doom Roller.
Dr. Doom, Doom Roller, Turbo Cycle, and Captain America each sold separately. Batteries not included.
Let's roll. Doom Roller, that's it. Ferris wheel can't stop the turbo cycle.
Change course, Doom Roller.
Now, Turbo Cycle, you're doomed.
Doom Roller and Turbo Cycle vehicles from the Marvel Superheroes Secret Wars collection, each sold separately. Action figures also sold separately. New from Mattel.
It's your secret. Yeah. It's your secret. Tell it to me.
Hey heretics, Doomrakers here from the Comic Doom Bunker, along with Kevin World Doom X, Andrew the LA Doombot, and Stoic Phil, ever steadfast. Hero of the Colosseum, they say, though. Welcome, guys.
Hey,
I feel
Steve.
Like we need a dictionary now.
If we're going to do the Secret Wars, should we have like a little Secret Wars, Secret Wars, like a theme song or something?
Are you sure this isn't a House of M podcast?
Age of Apocalypse, 1602. All right, you can find us on Twitter at Marvel Noise and at Steve Raker and at WWXKev and at LA_Rabbit1 and at Me and My Sloth. And you will have links there to our forums on the 11 o'clock comics threads. And I want to give also a little shout out to the upcoming New York special edition, the first weekend in June down in New York City. And it's never too early to start thinking about September. Late September is the Baltimore Comic Con, and those are my next two big stops.
I will be at San Diego Comic Con International, which is a comic book related festival held in July in San Diego.
Nice. Very good, Andrew.
I'm Canadian. I have no plugs.
Well, I had a plug, but, you know.
So what we wanted to do was to go over, I mean, I was very skeptical about going into the Secret Wars, but now it is starting to...
You mean House of M.
Demonstrate itself as to kind of what some of the scope of this is going to be. And I'm pretty interested. And I think as more titles are released, it would be fun to kind of meet in an ongoing way and kind of catch people up and serve as a guide to what some of the different issues and tie-ins contain. So when we talk about this stuff, it'll be slightly spoilery enough to steer you to the material, but won't give away the real goods. But I want to at least mention some of the characters that are involved so you can make sure you catch the stuff that will interest you, because it seems like there's going to be a lot of books, guys.
And if you're always worried about it, you can just let it sit for a week or two and listen to it once you've read the books, too.
Well, with Secret Wars 2 itself, I mean, guys, now this is getting going here. I mean, we met right after Secret Wars 1, and it just seemed, everything seemed to be bottlenecking. And in some ways, this should have been issue number 1, this issue number 2. And funny that Hickman, the writer, says that it was actually produced and drawn by Ribic before issue number 1, because they needed to, this was the one that really set the world up, and they needed to distribute this to all of the tie-in creative teams so that they could, you know, have the designs of things and see how things were going to work. So not only was this a primer for the other creative teams, but it also was a great primer to what this whole Battle World and Secret Wars is to us, the readers.
I gotta say, I was a little bit disappointed we didn't get a real cover again.
Yeah, I knew you were gonna be.
Oh, and I
maybe
wanna...
if it was another dollar, they would give you a real cover.
Give you guys a quick, not to derail Steve, but I just wanted to quickly say, I read the Free Comic Book Day Secret Wars number 0 out of order. I read it 1-0-2. And I gotta say, I bet you most of your comic stores will have a copy of this laying around. I really liked it. There's not much substance to it, but it really sets up kind of the idea of the escape raft and kind of sets the stage in motion. And I thought it was totally worth reading. You know, it's just the half book, and the other flip half is the Inhumans thing. No, the Avengers thing. And then they have the Attack on Titan Avengers crossover. But normally these... zero issues are kind of hit or miss, but what I liked was it was not necessary, but it was new content, mm-hmm. but not needed, but added to the thing.
Not just the first six pages of another series that then directs you to that to continue
yes.
on.
which I'm kind of used to. So I was really, so if you were like me and thought, oh, the Zero issue is not, you know, it's not going to be anything. It is something. So it's worth,
it is like in fact a prelude.
You can, and you should be able, I've done this in the past, gone to an LCS and just asked, and if they have leftover copies, they'll usually give you one.
Possibly not mine. I'm just kidding. In Secret Wars number 2, we learn about the post-extinction event world of Battleworld, finally. It's been cobbled together by its god. It's God Doom.
Finally. It's all Emperor again.
Yeah, where all hope lies, remember?
This is true. He wasn't lying.
That's kind of what I was worried about, though. Like, it's not a complaint because I'm enjoying it a lot, but it has a real House of M feel to me. And I was kind of hoping all the heroes from these different universes would have their same memories.
It was more of an Age of Apocalypse feel to me, really. So.
It's a little of both and all and something of its own too, the way that it's all really thrown together. You know, having Doom be there, I mean, it's all the continuation of Hickman's FF run, which is great. This has all been leading all along. Valeria telling Doom that, like, hey, there's no beating this. You're going to have to figure out a way to ride with it and turn it to your advantage instead. All that. It's all come full circle. And you get to see the battle world that Doom put together through the eyes of a new recruit to the Thors, which is Doom's battle worldwide police squad. And they operate out of Doomguard.
Everything's Doom. I'm like, it was like that Marvel Atlas thing I read where he named everything Doom. And there was those classified things on the map, and I'm like, oh, come on. What would be so classified about a place that would give everything away? And really, it would have gave some stuff away. Like, you'd be like, why is everything named Doom?
Yeah, turning Asgard into Doomguard was definitely worth a reveal worth waiting for.
And to just repeat from before, we're dealing again with Jonathan Hickman, Issed Ribic, Ive Savorsina, the color artist, Chris Iliopoulos, letterer, production, Idet Winecore, and cover by Alex Ross. I just wanted to slip the credits in again, and apologies if I mutilated your names.
You know, we also get, at the same time as we have the world-building material here, where you're putting it all together, Hickman's also cleverly giving us signs of it already being picked apart, which is intriguing. Because you're getting to see the strength of it all as you're seeing how it's all built on top of itself. But then at the same time, you're seeing, you know, the little things. There's a shift to the territory of Utopolis, where we see some familiar future Foundation faces. Alex Powers, the Moloids, Dragon Man, and Bentley, guys like that. And they're exploring this pond well of water at the base of, like, a large crevasse. And gravity shifts to the point that when they pop out on the other side, they're on, like, the bottom side of Battleworld, and they're totally skating on the other side of the ice. It's really cool. It's a great visual. Very Dante. And it totally has this hidden, they're not supposed to find this vibe as they're exploring this under the crust area of the battle world. And
well, the cool thing is it's like skeletons of giants and stuff. And
yeah, it looks like they're climbing on top fossilized giant humanoid remains. And if you look careful, I think you can tell actually who those two bodies are, which tell I won't me. Give away.
Why not?
And they also discuss that there's a ton of evidence that Battleworld's not really a naturally occurring construct, but it's a composite of other worlds. But to think this is all heresy and causes doubt in Doom, and Doom won't have that.
No, he's going to have to bring in the Fringe team, and they're going to have to encase things in amber so no one will be able to get to that area.
Then they find in this under part of the battle world what looks like the circular life raft that our heroes flew off on, buried in the ground.
That was one of my favorite scenes.
Yeah.
In this book.
Really cool. I mean, it had that whole Ridley Scott Aliens vibe even to it, you know, seeing that circular ship, but then it's also reminiscent of that old silly arena from the first Secret Wars. It's really cool. The Thors all discuss the makeup of the battle world with this big strip of kingdoms that lie beneath this great North Sea, but above these southern Badlands. And the Thors have full jurisdiction across Battleworld. We see them sent to Bar Sinister to bring its Baron Sinister to before Doom. And Doom sits...
Sinister's awesome.
Yeah, he's a real snot. And he sits on this Asgardian world tree throne, Doom does. And he's got his sheriff, Stephen Strange, and a couple of choice blondes with him.
Yeah, the overshot is Doom runs everything, but he's carved up the world into baronies. So just, I think you're explaining the detail of sort of the 1,000-yard view, so that each one, and then, as you say, it's intimated that time has passed because the different baronies are vying for Doom's attention or to gain territory or lose to, like, it's very medieval in a way. In a sense, with Doom sort of sitting on his Lord High Manor, and it has that feel to it because he's appointed Strange as the sheriff, which feels very old-timey, and then Valerie is sort of his counter-advisor to it.
You're not going to talk about how he has a smoking Galactus?
No. There's all kinds of stuff like that peppered throughout here, guys, and that's what you're here for, to bring up little things that you thought was so cool.
Why is he smoking, though?
Because he's... trapped in his sentinel duty there. He's like on fire with cosmic flame, and in his palm is Franklin, because Galactus is Franklin's herald.
It seems like if you don't cause trouble, though, you don't try to take down Doom, like you can pretty much do what you want with your own area.
Franklin's in his hand.
You didn't read it?
I didn't notice that part, no.
they talk to him and he waves to them and everything. But anyway, this fantastic scene in Doom's throne world, we learn more about the battle world, that there's border rules of not being able to cross the borders, and that's pretty important. And we get to see how disputes are kind of handled, that Doom lets everything kind of be run within the territories by their barons, but if things rise to the threshold of needing his attention, he sends in his Thors, and they, you know, appear in court before him. Also, we get to see how Doom is influenced by his advisors, and then how the advisors all interact with each other, too, which is really cool.
Skeleton Birdman.
And like at 2000 AD, there's also a wasteland type where you can be exiled, which is pretty much guaranteed to be a gruesome fighting end if you're exiled out to the waste.
Well, it's the Ultron robots, it's the Marvel zombies, and it's the Annihilation Wave. So it's definitely somewhere you do not want to be.
And a bunch of Venom symbiotes, maybe.
Yeah, I was going to say it.
Or are they there, like, too?
Unless it was just zombie Venom.
I think that was just zombie Venom.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of weird things. I thought there was supposed to be a lot of ant creatures. And, like, it seems like the most horrible things in the Marvel Universe are in those lands.
Well, the ant creatures are the Annihilation Wave.
That's right.
It all gets explained by Senior Thor to this rookie Thor that we get to view the world through, and we get to see them escort a punished Baron to the shield, which is the big wall, great wall that separates all this craziness from the civilized world of Battleworld.
That's my other favorite scene, that one.
Yeah, and then we get to see this Baron thrown to the Deadlands and fight it out.
Oh, yeah, there's the Franklin scene. Okay.
Then there's an end scene that's crazily intriguing. Strange sends the Thors to quarantine off the raft, and when they get there, it ends up opening, and it's totally not who you think that comes out.
I know. That totally got me.
And then we get an updated Battleworld map with the Doomstat and the capital city and Doomguard, where the Thors hail from, and the Valley of Doom now identified.
Pretty cool. It looks like the heroes won since Doom is ruling everything. Like that's the status quo I want to maintain here. Like, he's the man.
I got to say, too, that there's a pretty nice two-page spread kind of steering you towards different tie-ins that give you pretty good-sized thumbnails to see some of the covers, and I think it's kind of displayed in a not-too-chaotic, clumsy type way. I think it's pretty cleverly and nicely put there in a design-wise. They did a good job with it. It's a good package. Good issue number 2.
Yeah, I would suggest it helps to at least it helped me a little to actually go over the map. Sometimes I know it's easy to sort of shine those things, but it helped me a little bit kind of place things in my head, like the wasteland and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Even more when we get into these tie-ins, guys.
Like, the wastelands has this, like, huge wall that just separates it from everything else.
All right, so Secret Wars Battle World is a good place to start for the tie-ins, I think. I don't know if any of you guys had a chance to read this one.
Yeah, I can't believe Kevin skipped this one.
This has a Paco Medina cover, and it is 2 10-page stories, and it looks like this is going to be the anthology book. Mm-hmm. The first story is by Joshua Williamson and Mike Henderson.
Which is based on one of my favorite What If comics, where the Punisher's fighting vampires.
And this is the Soldier Supreme, and yes, it is Battleworld's version of Simonson's new Fantastic Four. Called the Infernal Four, who are Limbo's hounds. It's Wolverine, the Ghost Rider, Hulk, and Spider-Man. And they're hunting down the Punisher, but he himself is haunted by an otherwise dead Doctor Strange, so he's hunted and haunted. Castle takes down most of them, but Strange's spirit jumps at the last minute to another host in an interesting twist that I guess is going to be followed up in the Inferno book that covers Limbo, which is area number 37 on the map.
It was also a cute melding of using the spells manifest themselves through modern weapons of, like, bazookas and machine guns and everything.
Yeah.
So that was a fun, and so that made it a fun, like, seeing the familiar Watoom and all the different sort of magical entities he conjures. But
did you guys ever
weapons.
Read that issue?
Yeah.
Of What If? Yeah.
Yeah. And do you know what Castle's crime was? He was crossing borders. So again, they're continuing to reinforce that like you stay in your area.
Right. Oh, and yeah, and basically, no one wants to get sent back to Doom. It could be potentially a fate worse than death.
Yeah, it's mean. You want to operate under, not be noticed, you know.
I always thought of Doom as a good guy, though.
The second story is by Ed Brisson and Scott Hepburn, and it's entitled MODOK Madness.
It is nonsense.
It is. AIM exists on Battleworld. They're scattered in hideouts across the world, it seems. And this particular facility from this story is in the War Zone, which is Area 22 on the map. And MODOK is a ruthless leader of this AIM faction, and he's got his beehive suited minions all gathering many MODOKs from across the land so he can finally have some reasonable competent peers for a change to deal and plan with. But let's say it doesn't go his way, and it's all pretty silly, but I guess good for a 10-pager.
Well, I think Kevin would like it.
Well, and I'm looking forward to the one when MODOK has the whole book, when it's that whole crazy assassin thing.
The good thing about this book, though, is since it's one and done stories, you can pick up whatever issues of the characters you like are. So
yeah.
It also was important, I thought, that it's established here that there are many AIM cells around that are heretical to Doom, and they want to take him down or replace him, and that the AIM is advanced idea mythologies instead of mechanics. And the Thors are often sent out to take down these different splinter cells of AIM.
I also thought, like, the creative team did a really fun, there's a full-page spread where they use the action on the page to form the panel boundaries.
Yeah.
And not just the panel boundaries, but then some of them are panel boundaries and some of them are just force lines. And I was like, that is a really cool kind of comic booky layout that I just looked at for a little bit, because I'm like, so which ones are the panels and which ones are the force? I mean, they're all force, and that's just one of those kind of unique comic book sort of storytelling devices.
Shoot me a tie-in. Who's got a request?
Master of Kung Fu.
Master of Kung Fu, written by Hayden Blackman, with art by Dalibor Talajek and Guan Suzuka, inker. Woohoo! And a Francisco Francavilla cover. This is Chapter 1, Master Drunk. I love it.
I was looking forward to this one.
The series is so kung fu-y, you guys.
Oh, it is like Dragon Ball, like all the Iron Fist stories I've ever read, and it's like Avatar, The Last Airbender, like all these things that put me in a good headspace. I'm like, yeah, it's all like in here.
We get the Kung Fu history of Battle World's Kunlun, number 11 on the map. Then we meet Shang-Chi. He's drunk in the park, but he's the son of the Emperor. And he starts getting pushed around by three of the Emperor's enforcers, like Typhoid Mary among them. And
oh, go ahead. There's so many cameos. Like, I don't even know who everyone is, but it's like familiar and unfamiliar characters. It's like, I'm sure everyone is someone.
And then after he gets pushed around a little by these guys, he drunkenly rises and then totally kicks their butt with his kung fu. We also get to see Kunlun's Morlocks, who get wind of the encounter and help Shang-Chi escape. You've got to see Lockheed the Chinese Dragon. that's a great idea. So then we see the Emperor. He is trying to get rid of Shang-Chi, his wayward errant son, and he sends what looks like is going to be like Elektra, Iron Fist, and this Laughing Skull character, which I was thinking, is he Madcap?
Gotta be Madcap.
And he's going to be sending them after Shang-Chi and the Morlocks. Should be pretty cool.
Does it have any tie-ins with the overall story? Like, it sounds like it's really on its own.
So far, it's all within the walls of Kunlun.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's see here. How about Spider-Verse? Spider-Verse was written by Mike Costa with art by Andre Araju under a Nick Bradshaw cover. I gotta say, just going into it, I like the Spider-Verse event way better. this has Spider-Gwen, Anya, one of Andrew's favorites there, Spider-Girl, and the Indian Spider-Man guy. As well as the Captain Brittany Spider-Man, Billy Braddock. They all meet and basically run afoul of Oscorp and discover being experimented on Spider-Ham.
Ooh.
So, then there's a 5-page ongoing Spider-Ham backup story.
Well, better than him being, like, roasted up or something, I guess.
What's well, not, there's an ongoing Spider-Ham, I'll be buying it.
What's not clear here, guys, is if they're kind of in Manhattan, Area 20, or if they're in the Spider-named Spider Island zone, Area 7.
Hmm.
And then I was thinking that the Battle World Manhattan is landlocked, though. And here we get to see the bridges and harbor docks that we're used to seeing, like, you know, in a Spider-Man comic. Spider-Gwen even references, you know, the George Washington Bridge and all that stuff. So I got to think that they're probably in Spider Island and that there's a good chunk of Spider Island that's also very New York-y.
Seems like it.
I guess this would tie into one of the other books, which has a close-up of the Manhattan Island, Ultimate End number one, which is Brian Michael Bendis and Mark Bagley. That one in the inside has Manhattan, but what's interesting is it still has the rivers by it, so you still do have docks and water and everything.
Okay.
But instead of going out into the world, it's got blue around it, but it shows little docks and the Hudson River. I just think it's too small, I guess, to show that on the map.
Good call.
And there it's got a legend with eight little mini further, like Nelson and Murdoch, New Ultimates Hideout, Avengers Mansion, Baxter Building, Earth 1610, The Ultimate Universe, Sanctorum, Stark Towers, and the Triskelion Ferry. So I know Phil read this one too.
Yep. And this one is interesting because I believe they have their memories, right? Like these are the real.
I'm not sure.
Like, it's hard to tell. Well,
yeah, because it focuses on the regular and the Ultimate Marvel Universe Manhattan mashup that's going on. That's Area 20 on the map. And that we're talking about that Andrew's saying has the rivers around the edges of it, which, again, makes me wonder where the Spider Island one was taking place. But it seems like several weeks or more jump between scenes. So time has definitely passed since the big Ultimate invasion of Marvel's Manhattan. Things are now like stabilized, like you get Spider-Man like fighting 2-bit crime, but
that's one of the problems is Spider-Man and Cyclops should be on the arc.
well, this is our Spider-Man in Manhattan, but also the ultimate version of Cloak and Dagger and Black Widow and stuff, and they kind of meet together and like take down what the Serpent Society in a kind of a, you know, a one-off kind of a battle there. What's funny is the ongoing thing of Spidey being pissed that everyone from the Ultimate World knows his identity. So they do know that there are two worlds together mashed there, but they seem to have their own explanation as to why that happened, because of something that Amadeus Cho did and that they were working on, and something funny went on that Stark worked, and all of a sudden there were two things, two worlds together, and all they know is they have to get one of the sets of Manhattans back to wherever they came from. But it doesn't seem like they know of the whole deal of the incursion to me. No one tips off anything along those lines.
Isn't that the whole MO for the Ultimate stuff, where they didn't tell their citizens like anything? They were kept in the dark?
But I mean, even the heroes, because like the Ultimate Universe's Triskelion building exists, and the Ultimate Nick Fury calls some of our heroes from the 616 to talk with theirs, and so you got like the two Tony Starks and stuff, and it's really weird. And again, it's hard to say what they remember. They remember their pre-Battle World selves, but they don't necessarily, again, remember how they got to where they are, and they have this other reason.
Well, the other thing that, remember, and like in the map shows, they have both Baxter buildings, so there is a mesh. At times, I wasn't always sure which version it was, because I'm not super familiar with the Ultimate, so that sometimes I read a scene the wrong way, like with the wrong version of whatever it is.
It shows how much they've changed the 616 characters to look more like those characters, because that's what they base the movies off of, right? So it's like Hawk, you hand Stan Hawkeye next to each other. Yeah, who knows? Which is
well, also with the Tony Starks, the only difference was the one drinks a lot.
And the other was in his armor, right?
Because they look splitting image identical of each other, which made it a little bit tricky at times. I mean, like I said, you figure it out. It just, we were kind of babied in Secret Wars 1 where they had that little map.
Yeah.
If you remember, and it said like, you know, and so you could quickly just go like, oh, and that, and my memory of that is what kept me going, because I remember that Cloak and Dagger there were from the Ultimate. So I'm like, these must be the Ultimate Cloak and Dagger. Because you can't always go by costume, because as you point out, people switch up costumes all the time, and they blend it into the movie costumes, and you don't know, you know, if they're... It's not like these things are strictly held to some model somewhere that someone's like, every time he shows up, he looks like this. You know, different artists are allowed to take it.
At least in the scene where they're talking to Fury up in the headquarters, they kind of, because they don't trust each other, they're at least kind of grouped standing in the group, right? So we got the 616 kind of group and the other group, and they're talking back and forth. And they don't trust each other, but they do agree that they need possibly to take down Doom. But they want to have to, they want to figure out a way that they can talk about this without, and staying under Doom's radar. And they keep alluding to something that Stark did that, you know, has brought the attention of Doom. And sure enough, at the end of the issue, a bunch of Thors show up. So we'll see where it goes from there.
And I thought there was, I couldn't locate it, but I thought there was some intimation in the main series that Manhattan was a bit of a no-go zone in general. But I'm sad to say that if such a reference exists, I am unable to locate it with my faulty memory as it stands now. But I thought this was pretty good. Barring my minor knock, I thought this one was interesting because, like Phil says, while they may not have, you know, we're not sure what knowledge they have of the event, they clearly know who they are, who each other are, and the sort of relationships going forward, as opposed to some of these other ones where you're put in some what-if type world or some, you know, I guess someone called it, what, the greatest hits mashup, where they're taking all these popular spin-offs and giving them their own time and spin. So I think that it works in that way.
Well, I think it's going to be an important part of the story, just because it's the two universes that smash together, you know, to start all this.
Right.
But at the same time, like I say, Spider-Man and Cyclops shouldn't be there, though, because they're on the arc. So I think that's a bit of a fumble. But that's probably why Andrew's point made sense about it being a no zone, because the Beyonders probably don't want them being messed up with the rest of the world, maybe.
Well, also, the whole thing creates a lot of weird logistical things that aren't worth thinking too hard about with all these things. Like, how is Manhattan being supplied with food and things like that, where if they really were cut off in these sort of weird places, it's not like
DC the grocery Convergence explained it with poison ivy.
Well, isn't everything in every place a no-go zone except for the Thors? Like, every place is isolated. There's not supposed to be any trade across, unless it's all orchestrated when, you know, hostilities are, you know, turn into alliances or something in the Court of Doom there. I didn't think there was a big...
The difference is, though, is these are like the heroes, some of the heroes that are going to save the whole...
Yeah, these are the prime versions. Absolutely.
But clearly he allows for the heads of them, the barons, have interaction, because in the main storyline they talk about how when we have our surrogate new Thor, who's our entry in, and the guy talks about how, you know, sometimes fortunes rise and fortunes fall. There are winners and losers in the Court of Doom, such as the former Baroness Pryor, unseated and contained by the absent Baron Summers. So clearly he does allow a certain amount of jockeying as far as between the upper top, between the top dogs. Like, I don't think he wants the peasant types mixing, but I think the bosses, you know, because Doom has a bit of the survival of the fittest type too. Like, if you can't hold on to your property, you don't deserve to hold on to it, I imagine, is one of the tenet, one of the written or unwritten tenets of Doom World.
But I think he wants the challenge to come from within the territory.
Yes.
Say, shouldn't some of this stuff be about the Beyonders?
I'm sure it's going to get there. That's what's so cool. There's a whole other angle to get. Ah, man. This, we've got two big ones left, and save the what I thought was the best one for last. So let's do A-Force number one, written by Marguerite Bennett and G. Willow Wilson, and drawn by Jorge Molina, with inks by Craig Young. And it's sporting a Jimmy Chung cover that we saw for months in the previews. And we're introduced to Arcadia, which is number 35 on the map, one of only two large islands in the entire battle world, Spider Island being the other island. Arcadia, A-Force. Get it? Now it makes sense.
I am not a fan of the A-Force name. It, I think it's weird. Not particularly dynamic or interesting or whatever. No.
Arcadia is a paradise. A paradise island. With minimal crime, the defenders are all metahuman females, and there's a bit of Wonder Woman, Amazonian vibe going on. There's kind of a JLA vibe with the Hall of Justice that they name, that they is their headquarters, and it's kind of a Legion of the Superheroes vibe, because they all fly around on patrol, even the Dazzler and America from the you know, Young Avengers, and neither of them are flying characters, so it's almost like they have their little flight rings and they go on their patrol.
That sounds kind of cool, though.
It is, but it seems like it's a cute Silver Age nod to that stuff. She-Hulk, she's the Baroness of Arcadia. And a big shark attacks one of the boats outside of Arcadia, the fishing boats. And there's a really weird sequence with the Dazzler's laser making a boom sound. And then the enormous, I swear to God, almost kaiju-sized shark goes flying up out of the water and is beached. And I looked at this sequence over and over and over again. And I still can't figure out what the heck's going on. But as the physics of it, at least. But anyway, America, the girl from, you know, the last version of the Young Avengers there, she hurls the shark off the island, and it's close enough to the Deadlands and Badlands there below the shield that she flings it over the shield. It hits the edge of it, though, and takes a little chunk off and lands into the Deadlands, Area 38. And there's also, though, I thought a really weird, it seemed out of place, she makes a PETA reference when she throws the shark, and it's like, would they have like PETA here?
Why not? They have superpowers.
I guess if anywhere they'd have it, it would be in Arcadia, but it was strange. But this, it turns out, because she chucked the shark across borders, it's a big law break. No crossing the borders. No damaging the shield either. Come on now. And Sheriff Strange comes and she hears Baroness She-Hulk's plea, but he sends the Thors to take her away. And it seems like instead of getting chucked into the Deadlands, she is going to serve her sentence at the shield, helping defend the shield, which one of the that senior Thor guy in Secret Wars number 2 was explaining to the rookie that many a century and many a Thor have fallen protecting the shield from all the chaos that's on the other side.
She might show up in another series then.
You never know.
I found my pointless reference. It was Doom was talking about Manhattan is rumored to be the link to where you go if you're next to the silent chambers where the people who are trying to throw rumored to be against Doom are. That's kind of the bit I was referring to.
No, I thought that, no, that was in the Braddock's kingdom, because that's the whole reason that he wants him to name where the tunnels are, and he won't, and that's why he gets sent over the wall.
But the way he phrases
and Avalon.
Higher Avalon sits below the Kingdom of Manhattan and is long rumored to be the most favorable conduit. So I guess the question, is it modifying the Higher Avalon or is it modifying Manhattan?
No, below, he means in a north-south kind of a way, just on the map. Look at your map.
Right, but what I didn't know if the clause was modifying the Manhattan or the Avalon, the after clause.
Yeah, but we know that the tunnels were in Avalon because he killed off the Baron of Avalon for not divulging their... Every time they find someone from the tunnels or whatever, they have only one word on their lips, and it's Braddock.
If I was Doom, I'd send you both over the wall right now.
But two things happen at the end of A-Force. One is that the She-Hulk calls upon the Submariners, Namor, Namora, and it looks like the Chimera version of Namorita, to search the ocean for the source of the giant shark, the one that caused them to lose their sister. They think something might be behind this, and they find something. And then secondly, a surprise female cosmic character falls from the sky and crashes into Arcadia, and she's found but not recognized. I thought this was a good ish, a good setup. But I guess I'm alone in that.
I didn't. That in Spider-Verse just didn't.
I didn't get to the store much, but I hope to have some more issues soon.
I wish I didn't skip Kung Fu. I don't know why I did, but
there's still time.
You didn't hear me raving enough, saying, "Hey, this could be good."
Planet Hulk, number one, written by Sam Humphries with fantastic art. I gotta say, by Mark Lanning. Mm-hmm.
Really? Did you notice there's a She-Hulk shore in the map?
Yeah, that's cool. We get a closer map of Greenland, which is the most northern feature of Battleworld that is separated, completely cut off from the rest of Battleworld by the large northern sea, the Sea of Monsters, as it says here. Mm-hmm. We get seven features of Greenland: Mud Kingdom, She-Hulk shore, which I found interesting because She-Hulk is the Baroness of the other area, right?
I'm guessing it's just going to be a bunch of women Hulks, like a Amazon tribe almost.
There's Port Banner, Gamma Lake, the Badlands, the Tribal Hulks, Barons, and Fang Mountain, which I'm guessing slash hoping is going to be like Fang. Yeah.
Oh, I was thinking Wolverine.
Oh.
What?
No, remember he fought that Wolverine guy from the Imperial Guard?
They always fight.
Oh, Fang, he's in the Imperial Guard, but why would he be with the Hulks?
I don't know, it's just some obscure mention.
I wish, but it wouldn't make sense, though.
The Hulks here on Planet Hulk, they have this antagonistic relationship with the Thors. There's lots of back and forth. Every time they kind of build up a faction, the Thors come and bust them up a little bit and try to keep them from getting anything too big going. We also get introduced to the Kilisium that's on the outskirts of Doomstat, which is number 19 on the map.
Which in the back they say is going to be in the Ghost Racers comic also.
Yeah. And number 19 on the map, this Doomstat, the capital city, it's square dead center in the middle of Battleworld. And there's this Captain America gladiator type and his pet devil dinosaur that fight in the arena. and after a series of events, Cap is sent to Doom, and his sheriff, Stephen Strange, addresses Captain America and ultimately sends him and his dinosaur on a mission to Greenland to take out the Red King, which I'm assuming is going to be the Red Hulk, right? And he's told that Bucky is being held prisoner by the Red King, so...
And that Bucky page is weird. It's creepy. They gave each other some questionable looks.
So in they go. And it's pretty harsh when they get there. And so they've got to infiltrate this crazy place and learn about it. We'll learn about it through Cap's eyes. There's also kind of a cool 8-page backup with a faux cover that relates how the planet of the Hulks was created, where Phoenix, Arizona was blown up in a irradiated in like a gamma bomb explosion when Amadeus Cho saved it from being obliterated, but instead gamma gassed and everyone turned into a Hulk. And part of that, you know, that city was put into Battle World here.
That was supposed to be the secret creative team that they said in the solicits.
Who cares about any of that? Devil Dinosaur is his pet.
That is pretty
cool. That's awesome. No Moon Boy or anything?
Not yet.
Who needs Moon Boy? We don't need him.
I agree with Phil. Who needs Moon Boy?
So the only other seemingly related crossover was the Deadpool Secret Wars.
But yeah, I read that.
You know what? It turns out to not really be.
It's nonsense.
He's got the wrong Secret War.
Secret Wars. What's Dr. Doom's mission, Secret Shield?
If you're a Deadpool fan, here you go.
It's Enjoy. Funny. You know, they always have a Deadpool limited series going along with a regular Deadpool title. So this is, I think, a fun way to do... they're doing him, like, behind the scenes and involved in the first Secret Wars.
And it's also a Contest of Champions. And it seemed like
funny as hell.
A couple pages even took place in the Battle World now. Like, the one where all the Avengers are destroyed. Like, that's in... I think the Battle World now, no?
I guess, yeah.
And then at the end, you see him with a mustache.
Like, yeah, I'm not sure what that's all about.
Me neither. I didn't understand that.
We'll see. We also learned news-wise that after this whole Secret Wars event, when it's over and the Marvel Universe kicks off with, I'm sure, a whole new series of number ones, it's going to be 8 months later, guys. There's going to be an 8-month gap. But they hinted that some of the variables that are going to carry over from the Secret Wars are things like the Maestro, A-Force.
Yeah, that was a cool one, Maestro.
The Howling Commandos, which makes Rick Remender happy because he's been asking for that for years.
No, isn't it? Oh, is it just the Howling Commandos or is it them and Deadpool's dumb wife?
We'll see.
It depends who you think the Howling Commandos are.
Yeah.
And Weird World, which we'll see what that title ends up.
Yeah, I'm hoping that's good. I have high hopes for that one.
So cool. I'm all in now. I was skeptical going into this, but they're doing it cool. I'm very interested. I'm having fun with it.
Well, you could really pick and choose what you like too, I think. So like any storylines you liked in the past, you can just grab those, or you definitely don't need them all.
Yeah, Mr. Marvel's always a skeptic. What a guy.
Well, I like how, as Phil says, not only that, but they're, as they did with Marvel now, you know, the books have different feels, different art styles, different storytelling techniques, different, you know, you're getting all kinds of, I mean, hopefully it's a storyline you like matched with the creative styling that you like, but I always appreciate when they mix it up and have different looking and feeling and vibing stories.
We actually didn't talk about the Last Day comics, though. I didn't pick up any of those, but some of them look kind of interesting to me because there is Mighty Avengers, Loki, Magneto. I think that's it so far.
That's because we look forward, Phil. We're not looking back.
It'd probably be some cool conversation, like character pieces of just them, you know, like knowing the world's coming to an end.
Do they now?
Well, I know, like, Magneto has a conversation with Namor. I bet you that's pretty interesting.
And I got to say, with the whole, you know, being skeptical going into this, I just don't have a good history with the big, you know, I loved What If. I read the whole first series and most of the second series. I like the little alternative views into things, but I haven't, it hasn't jived with me when they've done it line-wide for a while. I really, you know, Age of Apocalypse was interesting, but it didn't really capture me.
But what about the Korvac?
The House of M, it didn't really capture me. Some of the other weird ones that they've done along the lines of 1602 didn't really capture me.
Yeah,
Civil War didn't really capture me. Oh no, that was in continuity, no, supposedly. Heart.
What?
But you know, so but this has got me so far.
But what about like Korvac Saga? You must be excited for that.
Well, I love the original Korvac Saga, yeah.
And then this is with the original Guardians and everything.
Yeah, well, I love the original Guardians. I'm saying I am enjoying this so far.
You'll enjoy it all.
All or nothing.
Or Phil's going to show up at the bunker and make you enjoy it.
Yeah, at the Doom bunker.
With some Thors.
I'm excited for this. I just hope to see the Beyonder soon, but I think I'll be very happy when this is all done.
Yeah, already there's threads being pulled at this reality, though, so it's going to be interesting to see whether we get how much of a sense of the place we get before it all starts really unraveling.
Yeah.
Wait, so this isn't the permanent new status quo for the Marvel U?
Well, it might be the permanent status quo for Battleworld. There's no reason why Battleworld can't exist after and, like, some group of...
Sure, there is, because we're going to be tired of it after this many series.
All right, gang. Thanks for going over this with us, and let's do this again when there's another chunk of material out there.
Secret Wars.
I like cookies.
Battle World.
All right.
Should they have called it Battle World instead of Secret Wars?
I wish they called it Secret Wars.
But Battle World is just a banner for some of the books.
They got to keep the name, and they got to keep the name. Use the name every once in a while. You know what I mean? To keep it their hold over it.
It's an anniversary too.
Because it just seems like I don't know. It doesn't feel super Secret Warsy to me.
No.
As you guys were saying, it doesn't have the kind of
because they don't have their real memories.
The kind of beats to, I mean, Secret Wars is a big toy shilling punch up. You know what I mean? And I don't mean that in the bad way. I mean, it has some bad elements to it, but, you know, that's the whole fun of it, in a way. Although I do love, and it's just me being old and crazy, but I do love that they keep doing that playset ad, the Hasbro playset, in the main title, because it reminds me so much of the... I think they did a really low-budget playset for the first Secret Wars.
Secret Wars, such Dr. Jules' mission, Secret Shield.
Well, yeah, because they had a Secret Wars line there. That's where they had the hologram shields.
Yeah.
Remember?
Yeah. I still have the Iron Man from that.
Mm-hmm. I was just out of action figures by the time they hit, and I was like, "Do I really want to?" And I'm I don't.
Oh yeah,
I'm just not gonna.
Those were like the first good Marvel ones.
I was like 15. I know, but I was like 15, dude. I was like,
"That's all right."
I bought them.
Dr. Octopus was awesome.
It's your secret. Yeah, you know. It's your secret. Tell it to me. Oh, when you tell it to me. Oh, when you tell it to me.
Hey, happy listeners. Steve Raker here again from the Comic Book Bunker. Now and then I'd like to present limited series and even the Digital Infinite comic to you guys, because, you know, not being part of the regular title, maybe your regular pull list, I suspect many pass over limited series or find themselves, when they hear it announced or beginning to be released, waiting for it to be collected and then either forgetting to check it out or, you know, just ignoring it. So I try to give you the skinny on what's in these side project limited series, and I have a few for you here this episode. Two recent, and one from 1994. It's closure, you'll see. It'll all make sense. Remember when Deadpool had like 3 or 4 titles going? I like the current structure of having a main Deadpool series and a limited series. They always have one limited series going. And then as soon as that one ends, the next one kicks off. Sometimes they even overlap an issue. And I think Deadpool lends himself well as a character to the whole side tale limited series model. He's, you know, he's the Bugs Bunny of the Marvel Universe. He's the Looney Tunes, right? He breaks the fourth wall, and he's the type of guy who could take a bucket of black paint and, you know, paint a big tunnel hole on a brick wall and step through it and have the guy chasing him hit it, you know? Depending on who's writing, of course. But, well, here I've got Return of the Living Deadpool, which just finished up. It was from this past winter in 2015. 4 issues, written by Cullen Bunn with art by Nick Varela. And this is the sequel to The Night of the Living Deadpool, which came out last year, which itself was a enjoyable limited series, putting Deadpool right into the middle of the Night of the Living Dead world. This limited series does sport a parental advisory on the cover. The covers are by Jay Shaw. And like the Night of the Living Deadpool series, the entire series is black and white and gray tones. Like it's a black and white movie, right? Except Deadpool himself is full color, so he's got his big red totally standing out all the time, just like in the original series. Except here, the effect is totally amped up, as you'll see, or hear about, dear listener. So, why Deadpool's there? When he wakes up, he doesn't know. He can't remember. He says, isn't that weird? And then it just moves forward. But even that gets explained. In the first issue, he meets this lone chick, and you know, she's a fighter, and they fight off a big horde of zombies, and she tells him, you know, don't let them, she explains, don't let them bite you, etc. And they escape, and then they run into a whole bunch of Deadpools, all also in bold red. So they're all full color, and there's just as many Deadpools as there are zombies, and they seem to be fighting almost like with a hive mind, and Deadpool has to help him and the female escape and learns a little bit about more about kind of what's going on. I should also say that the first issue's cover is a whole bunch of Deadpools and one lone zombie head peeking down as if at a worm's eye view, as if you're sort of in a grave looking up, contrasting the opposite of that, which was in the first series when they had all of the zombie heads with the one Deadpool red head peeking out. So Deadpool learns from this loner, tough chick, that after he sacrificed himself at the end of the first series, using his healing factor as a weapon against the zombies and letting them digest him, the zombies absorb Deadpool's consciousness too, and it transformed the ones who ate from him from being undead to an army of Deadpools with this hive mind. But they soon turned on the people they were supposed to be protecting and became a Deadpool plague that was worse than the zombie one that preceded it. So, and this memoryless Deadpool has a hole in his mask's forehead, like a vertical slit. It's because he lobotomized himself to free himself from the hive. So he's now the one true Deadpool, or as the other Deadpools called him, the Reject. The second issue is kind of a great train robbery type caper. The Deadpools are involved in human trafficking to make them into zombies and then have them eat of a Deadpool and then become more Deadpool so that they're replenishing their Deadpool and growing their Deadpool army. And Liz, the girl, she wants to rescue her family off the train of zombies and Deadpools. And there's also talk about a Deadpool-free zone that she is trying to rescue them, and then she wants to get to this Deadpool-free zone. And I should also say, Cullen Bunn's comments that he gives to the zombies when the zombies are talking are hilarious. I mean, some of them are just banal, but there's a few of them like, I have a peanut allergy, or it's couldn't care less, not could, one of the zombies is saying in between moans. My program's on. Uptown Girl is my favorite Billy Joel song. Really funny. It reminds me of Alan Moore's Weeping Gorilla quotes that were scattered throughout that Promethea series several years ago. In the third ish, Deadpool is leading the outcasts that he freed off of the train towards the Deadpool-free zone. But along the way, a bunch of them get captured and taken to Deadpoolopolis, so we get introduced to that. The fourth issue, Deadpool discovers, meets, and escapes the hive mind. It's really funny because there are religious factions within the Deadpools, and they are all based on a different writer that was handling the character at various times. So there's the Kellys, the Dugan and Posehns, the Simone religion, the Remender, or the Buns. Deadpool finally gets his crew, and what's left of them at least, to reach the Deadpool free zone, and then he's able to fulfill the Outcast's prophecy. There's a really cool ending, and then the chick, actually Liz, becomes a Lady Deadpool at the end, which is kind of neat. I found this series to be really entertaining, just like the first one, and I'm not sick of zombies. There you go.
Come on, police, arrest this man, he talks in masks, he buzzes like a fridge, he is like a detuned radio.
Now, the second limited series I have for you is Thanos vs. the Hulk, which was four issues at the end of 2014 into 2015, written and drawn by one of my favorite creators, Jim Starlin, and inked by Andy Smith with Frank DiArmada colors. Now, this is funny because this was originally intended to be just another arc. Well, just another. Jim Starlin drawing the Hulk. Come on. But I always liked his Hulk. He does that great upper lip thing that he gives to Thanos and other characters that he's drawn over the years, Lord Papal. Anyway, it was originally intended to be another arc in the Savage Hulk series, which was that short-lived series that had alternating creative teams doing arcs, a la the Savage Wolverine series from the last few years. Now, when I saw Jim last September at the Baltimore Comic Con, which it's not too early to get tickets and be looking at BaltimoreComicCon.com to see about this year's show that's at the end of September 2015. Check it out. I'll be going. But without Jim's knowledge, marketing had the project changed from that to a standalone four-issue miniseries, even calling it Thanos versus Hulk to take advantage, obviously, of Thanos' popularity. And as Jim said, have they even read it? Like, do they even know that Thanos is only in the first two issues? It's really a Hulk story, and it's a and he fights Thanos in the beginning and then meets Blastar and Annihilus, and it's kind of a Hulk Pip the Troll story, and Jim was sporting some Hulk Pip the Troll artwork at the time, which had me inquire about the project, which led to a really nice conversation. He and Bernie Wrightson are still those two creators for me that I get all goofy around and have an extra spring in my step after seeing. Anyway, it's set squarely in the Marvel Now era with Iron Man's gold and gray armor and Banner working for Maria Hill as an agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. and all that. And Maria and Tony are observing security footage of Pip the Troll teleporting, basically abducting Banner. And Pip the Troll is one of the Infinity Watch, one of Starlin's old characters from the old Warlock series back in the 70s, for crying out loud. Basically, what you have to know about him is that he's kind of a Howard the Duck type in his demeanor, and he teleports. So Pip delivers Banner, and then basically the Hulk, to Annihilus and Blastar in the Negative Zone. He did it to rescue a girl. His motives weren't all bad. But then afterwards, he does realize that he really should have that whole Hulk, Annihilus, Blastar, and whatever they had in mind for him situation checked by somebody. So he figures out, I will try to get Thanos on his tail. So he visits and ultimately piques Thanos' curiosity. You know, they both used to be in the Infinity Watch together. Well, Annihilus is, at this time, still a little thing, right? Secondary to fallout from Hickman's Fantastic Four run. His plan here is to siphon some Hulk mojo off the Green Goliath and use it to jack himself up. Trans-Hulkrification. Hulk fights Thanos all throughout issue 2, and Blastar and some of the Annihilation Wave gang in issue number 3, and then Hulk has to try to survive a gamma-irradiated Annihilus Hulk in issue number 4. Pip the Troll is also influencing events to the best of his ability along the way with his teleportation abilities, including pulling the Hulk out and sending him home in the end. It was a really good, simple read. I really like Jim, looking at Jim Starlin's artwork, and I've always liked his Hulk back from the old days, so I thought it was fun, and it touched upon some of the other, you know, it reminded us that Pip is still around, you know? In addition, along the way, Starlin depicts Abnett and Lanning's homage, that stellar intergalactic pub, Starlin's. And Jim has some fun with the scene, inserting characters like Wendell Vaughn and Quasar, Gorgon and Karnak of the Inhumans, Zippy the Pinhead-type guy, and I think himself, as well as Gamora, Drax, and Ronan, the modern versions of them. Jim sticks with the continuity. He puts them all into the background. It's cool. And there was some nice nostalgic Ron Lim variant covers, too. They should look good in the upcoming trade paperback. I'm sure they'll all be included. You know, besides reestablishing Pip the Troll in continuity, I think a big purpose here also seemed to get Annihilus back into his place and assuming his role of dominance by transforming him from Hickman's little Annihilus to that jacked-up, gamma-irradiated Annihilus with the cool Kirby-ish headdress carapace that Starlin gave him, which is just in time for Jim to use Annihilus in the Infinity Revelation original graphic novel that is going to feature Thanos, Annihilus, and Adam Warlock. Oh, yeah. And that should be upcoming. I gotta say, too, while I'm thinking of the Hulk, I just gotta throw in there, Hulk number 16, which was the finale to the Jerry Duggan-written era, drawn by Mark Bagley with inks by Hennessy. It was good. There was a 19-page story. You know, Hulk has been Doc Green, and he is extremist-infused, you know, Tony Stark's extremist thing, so he's, like, super smart, and he's been hunting and curing gamma-irradiated individuals against their will. He cured Rick Jones and went after the Red Hulk and got him and all these various guys, right, and the leader. And he's finally confronting She-Hulk, and it's all been leading to this, and we've been waiting for this big confrontation. And he's got the last vial of the cure there. And she's all backed by the Avengers and the Fantastic Four and stuff. And Hulk's like, I just totally want to talk. And that's all they really do. And the conversation, the dialogue is so awesome. Bagley goes beside himself, drawing a really nice issue of faces and expressions and angles, making it really interesting because the conversation is really important to what's been going on. He explains his fear of the whole Maestro threat, that he would reinfuse himself with more extremists, but he's afraid that if he sticks around like this, he's going to become the Maestro, and he's going to let himself degrade, and he's going to lose this intellect, and he's basically going to let himself die. The who he is going to die. He's going to become Hulk Smash again. And he gives Jen the vial, explaining that it's for her to use against him if he ever starts getting maestro-y. Oh, so good. And there's also a nice Bruce and Betty moment to end the series as well. Then there's a 10-page Aubrey Sitterson written and Roald Marsilius backup, where Doc Green's agents, these two guys that have been working for him, find and, it turns out, accidentally rescue the Lyra She-Hulk, who's been lost in interdimensionally. She actually had a pretty sweet setup going for herself. Little did they know. But all the dangling ends are really tied up nicely. This 16 issues of this Hulk run were really among my favorite of the Peter David stuff, even. Really good. Really enjoyed it. Come on, please. I've given all I can, but it's not it. All right, the last limited series I have for you. Time for the big reveal. It's the Galactic Guardians. It's the four-issue limited series from the summer of 1994. This is the big finish to the original tales of the original Guardians of the Galaxy and everything related. And we've had extensive coverage that I will recap at the end of this synopsis here. Written by the Guardians of the Galaxy regular writer Michael Gallagher, with art by the regular art team of the series, Kevin West and Steve Montano. We're talking all post-Jim Valentino era here. The Galactic Guardians are led by the crystalline Martin X from the Guardians of the Galaxy, one of the founding members, right? Fire Lord, Phoenix Nine, who is a male host, the Ghost Rider, Replica, who is this Skrull teen girl, Hollywood, Simon Williams, Wonder Man from our time, who has lived on, and Mainframe, who is a discorporeal vision who's merged with this computer planet to turn it into the New Haven to make a place for a mutant colony in outer space. And that planet, unfortunately, the life support goes off, and the Galactic Guardians are headquartered there, and they must protect the planet at all cost. And it basically, the idea of the life support going off, and it seems like it's just a function for the Phoenix to be taken off the grid, effectively, while he single-handedly battery sustains the planet's life support. With him out of the way, Replica becomes a tiny alien parasite mite and searches Mainframe circuitry to discover why the life support went off, and discovers this protoplasmic blockage. And she returns and reports, but then becomes gravely ill, and at the end of issue 2, a gruesome spinal cord nervous system looking thing called ganglia emerges really forcefully from Replica's insides. Right out the mouth, but think like, you know, Ridley Scott alien stuff. Ganglia is the first of a foursome that our Galactic Guardians must encounter. There's also the physically powerful Silverback, who attacks Heimdall at the gates of Asgard and then faces off against Woden, the son of Thor. And Fire Lord then feels what it's like to burn from the interdimensional fires of Hazmat. Although Hazmat gets his when he tries the same trick unsuccessfully on the Ghost Rider, who then takes his turn burning the unburnable. Ghost Rider throws a flame ball at Hazmat, and Hazmat's boasting that he'll catch it and throw it right back at the Ghost Rider, and instead it blows off Hazmat's hand. That's not good. So Ganglia, Silverback, and Hazmat, that's three. I said four, though, right? Well, while Replica was searching his circuits, Mainframe went mobile as a humanoid vision to track down Hollywood, a.k.a. Simon Williams, who, if listeners recall from the last Guardians of the Galaxy segment on Marvel Noise 243, he was on a brutal tear through the galaxy for info that would put him on Dr. Doom's trail. Well, the vision pulls him away from that quest, and it's just too reminiscent of how the vision teleported Wonder Man away from Earth at a crucial moment as the heroes began their final and fatal, the Vision argues, assault on the invading Martians in the Killraven Martian invasion that is in continuity with the future Guardians timeline, which of course branched from the 616 in Marvel 2-in-1 number 69 when Vance Astro of the Guardians of the Galaxy met young teenage Vance Astro of our continuity, and we ended up with Marvel Boy Justice character and all that. Well, Simon Williams is pissed. The Vision maintains that he, Eon, and Dr. Druid had determined that the Earth was a lost cause, and it was going to fall to the Martians. It was inevitable. Vision also tells Simon that someone that's been known to him all along was externally aiding the Martian invasion, and that he's finally, for the first time in over 10 centuries, uncovered some clues as to put him on the trail of who that might be. So that's important. But we, however, thanks to my last Guardians of the Galaxy segment, know that it was Eon pulling all the cosmic strings that led to Earth's fall. Well, Eon's evil offspring, posing as Eon. So Simon, Hollywood, is mad at the Vision for interrupting his quest for Doom, for teleporting him from the Martian War, and overall for not believing in the human spirit and that they could have won with everybody's help if everyone was on site. Remember, Eon also pulled the Silver Surfer out of there. But they get interrupted by a crashing spaceship, It's an alien pilot seemingly injured in the wreckage, and it's discovered by Simon and the Vision. It's all very Green Lantern-like scene, but the little blue alien, he's playing possum, and his name is Savant, and he puts the pair down almost instantly by wiping their quote-unquote primitive minds. Then he just reinserts only their hate and lets them go at it, just going at each other for a few more rounds. In issue 3, after Hazmat is defeated by the Ghost Rider, that flame is tough to beat, a mysterious, unshown leader type comes and scoops him up. And Ganglia, meanwhile, does battle with Martin X, who pretty much is standing his own by alternatingly freezing Ganglia's Ganglia, but it's again Ghost Rider's Hellfire that really proves intolerable, especially when combined in a crossfire with a revived Fire Lord's flames. Then Ganglion gets teleported away with the touch of a benefactor's hand, too. The giant Silverback, he also gets bested by Woden, who flies off, doesn't even notice that Silverback is then saved by the same mysterious being. She comments on his disappointment of him. And then, with those formative, but basically jumps out of the way, the Vision reinstalls himself as Mainframe, which frees up the Phoenix. So, with Hollywood's return, the Galactic Guardians are finally back at full fighting strength. For all the good it will do them, when Silverback, Ganglia, Hazmat, and Savant all show back up, along with their armored female leader, the omnipotent, omnipresent Ubiquidor. Mainframe reveals that his Vision that was mobile there with Simon Williams, who had his mind wiped, was only part of his consciousness. The rest stayed home and built a backup that was then sent to revive Wonder Man by instilling his essence and memories back. All unedited, so he feels all the pain of the whole Martian thing and everything. Hollywood quickly takes out Silverback by just pounding on him and flying out into orbit with him. And Savant falls when attempting to manipulate the very formidable Mainframe. That's not an interface that's going to work. Kind of cooks Savant's head. Ubiquidor explains that she is the last of an ancient race that's part of the natural order of things, blah, 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 cannot be stopped. She moves between dimensions, and that's how she picked up this foursome. And she's kind of a force of multiversal consumption and contraction. Destruction, that's the important thing. She's got to be stopped. Martin X takes out Hazmat by scrambling his biochemistry and hits him with simultaneous hot and cold blasts. Ooh, and then Ganglia tries to infect the Ghost Rider and becomes bound to him, trapped forever to infect the tortured souls of the damned within the Ghost Riders. Ubiquidor then teleports away with Phoenix 9, saying she's never met a being so powerful that it borders on absolute, and you know, you'd make a good consort by my side and all that. But Phoenix totally rejects Ubiquidor's offer, and her full fury is unleashed upon him. Phoenix is just barely keeping Ubiquidor in check when Woden, son of Thor, shows back up and adds the might of Mjolnir against the invader. The resulting explosion is so strong that it reminds me that in space there is no sound, but apparently there are Macbeth quotes. The Galactic Guardians then regroup, posture, and the tale ends. And that, my friends, for real this time, is the end of our massive Guardians of the Galaxy coverage. From the early stuff right up into before Bendis' revamp happened and Peter Quill went blonde again. So, to recap, Jerry McDade and I, we covered the exploits of the original Guardians of the Galaxy, from their inception to their first hiatus after Marvel 2 and 169 on Marvel Noise episode 204. Jerry and I then regrouped and covered Valentino's 90s Guardians of the Galaxy title on episodes 208 and 224. Then I took on the task of presenting the post-Valentino, otherwise known as the Gallagher West era of the title, solo on episodes 236 and 243. Also, we did the early publishing history of Star-Lord in episode 194, and Kevin Whirlwind X and I covered DNA's version of the Guardians of the Galaxy that inspired the movie in episode 225. And this bit finally finishes off the project. Thanks to Jerry and Kevin for helping me out along the way. And I'll talk to you guys later.
This is what you get. This is what you get. This is what you get when you mess with us.
Kevin, while you were offline, we all got our big maps out. We're all looking at
this. I wrote in the Doom territories.
Was so important that they had to classify that? Oh, now it makes sense. Well, how about that?
And I'm all for it. Now I get it.
Now it's awesome.
Yeah, it is. It's a map. Of course it's awesome.
It's sad. I see a map and everything, and I'm like, it's awesome. It has a map.
I'm already like, what am I going to mount this to make it, like, stiff?